Gentlemen, welcome to the Newmarket public meeting to bring awareness about matters concerning children's aid, the police, family court, criminal court, and the CAS invading our schools where they harass children to gather information. And all in a ploy to gather what I like to call it is to harvest children, which in fact is how the CAS gets paid. The Children's Aid Society is an organization that consumes $1.5 billion of tax dollars each year. The Children's Aid Society is a private organization. It is not run by the government, although all of their funding comes from tax dollars. Many people ask why we are here and why we are protesting some of the things that we have found at Canada Court Watch and other organizations as an issue of concern. We recognize that the Children's Aid Society has a place in our society, and in some instances they need to come in and intrude in our homes and provide protection for children. But what we are finding is far too often that is not the case. The real case is that they are simply looking to find an angle to get that $100, $200, $300 a day per child. If somebody dares to speak against them, it is not uncommon that an individual, a parent, will be targeted, false allegations will be brought against them, and they will find themselves in jail fighting two fronts, one to vindicate their names and clear their names in criminal court, while Children's Aid Society has your child in their care. Quite often it impoverishes people. It doesn't matter who you are. We have had police officers come looking for help. Pilots with Air Canada, lawyers, it doesn't matter. They have the benefit of the public purse, which is far deeper than any family's pockets. So the only place that really you can come to figure out how to deal with the Children's Aid Society is to an organization such as Canada Court Watch, who has been providing that kind of help to families for some 17 years at the hands of Vernon Beck, who founded the organization 17 years ago. Before we get into some of our speakers tonight, I would like to extend to you that the Canadian Maltese Charitable Service Trust, an organization that my father founded 16 years ago, is here to help families. Our position is, if there's a situation, whatever that situation may be, we should do everything that we can to keep that family together. And that is what our organization does. Over the years, we have raised over $250,000 that we have donated to various organizations in order to help people that need help. I find it very bizarre that, contrary to that, the Children's Aid Society could enter your home, and if they don't see your kitchen clean enough, if they don't see enough food in the fridge, they, instead of providing maybe $500 to buy groceries, if that's what the problem is, they will take those children, and instead it'll cost the taxpayer $3,000 a month. So, by example, the Canadian Maltese Charitable Service Trust wants to show that we would like to provide help within the community. So this year, we'll be providing Brad Jones Karate Do a check that will help the coaches. It will help young athletes who have no real means often, other than their parents, to cover costs, to travel to various countries when they achieve higher levels of accomplishment. And what the Karate Club does, what I have found over the years that I've trained, is it really grounds not just young children, but families. And I felt that it was very, very important that we would support that organization, our local karate club. So if I could have Peter Vincer, and if I could have the coaches from Brad Jones Karate Do, and perhaps if I could have you give a couple of words as to what it is that these coaches have created in terms of some fine athletes.
Oh boy.
Yeah. This is George Ucker.
I have with me, thank you, Senator Neville Longhurst and Mr. Kevin Jackson. That's not fair, you didn't tell me I had to say anything. Attila's raised a good point. I mean, we have been coaching a group officially for about 12 years. The Karate Club has sent members to the provincial competitions for years and years. We've had people going to national competition. We actually have departing, I think, not next Wednesday, the Wednesday after. Two kids are traveling out to Vancouver for the Canadian National Karate Championships. Thank you. And yeah, that gets expensive. They have to buy tracksuits, it's training time, travel, flight to BC isn't that cheap, hotels, etc., etc., etc. We try to raise funds within the dojo, but actions like this are absolutely tremendous, and we sincerely appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Okay, we're going to.
Oh.
Gives me a great deal of pleasure to present a check for $5,000.
What?
I'll see if I can fix it later. I don't know. I'll call you back some other time.
Hey, I think we need more shaking hands too.
I don't know if it's okay for me to say a few words, because I think It's a phenomenal gesture, and coming at it from a very different direction. As a coach, we work with the kids and we work with adults, and they get a lot of confidence out of it. The confidence that they get out of their training changes them as people. So when they go out into the community, they provide better examples in the community. One of the big things is, you know, the Dojo-kun, which is something that we say at the beginning and the end of every class. And one of the key elements of that is to refrain from violent behavior. So I want to bring that into that conversation.
Yep. I just add a little bit. I will say that this karate club, when I was going through some of my most difficult days with Children's Aid and Family Court, it provided me the grounding, and especially for one of my children, it was everything to him. And I don't think that he would have been able to get through things as well if he didn't have this organization, this place to train, and to have the coaches give him that confidence. And he was a better man, better young man as a result of it. Thank you for that.
Thank you all.
You're very welcome.
Something just over time already through the article about the Olympics. When is the Olympics, then we counting how many gold medals sports people are bringing home. So, but that's what my article. Olympic for the wealthiest people. Because the poor guys don't have even chance to send to the clubs to pay over there and the coaches and so to show up. That's why I think so from the US or from Canada, it is only just the healthy people who are able to pay all those expenses for the kids to reach and to show up. Let's have a power or whatever it is, you know. And I think so it's important to have the young people who is maybe a teacher or somebody is showing this, or is coming to the club and don't have a money, but have a talent to help. That's where we are deciding to be met.
So you just call that to your
conscience.
Yeah, you don't really get a check.
Yeah.
Next time I'm making it.
Now we have one more check that we will be issuing, and that one will be to Canada Court Watch. So if I could have Vernon Beck to receive this check. Again, I need to add, in and around the latter part of 2006, the early part of 2007, I literally, as a businessman, I knew that I needed to find information. I knew that I needed to get somewhere where I could get direction. And I searched everywhere. And it was actually at the Karate Dome that one parent said, you know, you need to get to know this individual. You need to go to Canada Court Watch, and they will be able to help you. And I did exactly that. I have to tell you that Vern guided me along the way, just told me when to turn, when to not do something, when to do something, taught me how to get file disclosure from CAS, taught me many things, even how to deal with the children as they were struggling through the horrors of what CAS had put us through. I made a promise to Vern, and I really believe in karma. What goes around comes around. I would not be wrong in saying that, never mind the monetary value, I probably saved hundreds of thousands of dollars in legal costs and other problems if I didn't have the benefit of Canada Court Watch. But more than that, my children live with me. And that doesn't happen very often. Most guys end up becoming Disney dads, where you see your children every other weekend. I'd like to see that change to, in a sad situation where we have divorce, that children would live with each parent equally. I think that would be the best solution. So at this time, if I could again have Peter to present the next check.
And may I say too that I just want to make sure I never gave you any legal advice. Remember that? I see there's lots of cameras here, and the Law Society might be down the next couple days.
Well, what Mr. Beck did is he just pointed me in the right direction, gave me the sections of the law, and it worked out very, very well. It's an equal pleasure to provide a $2,500 check to Canada Court Watch for the exemplary work that Mr. Beck has done over the years. I think this is a very little token of appreciation. Many don't know, but Mr. Beck travels all over, consuming his own gas money to all sorts of things out of his own pocket. Worth hundreds of hours in preparing documents. And I think what we're going to do is to make sure that we do a lot more. I'd like to see maybe somewhere in the $50,000 to $60,000 range so that he could apply himself to help families 100% rather than having to struggle to work and find time with his personal time to help families that are in need of that help.
I would certainly like to thank the Voluntary Charitable Service Trust for this check. There certainly is a project that I will be talking about when I speak, that this money will certainly go to help, which in turn is going to help many children and families right across the country, and to improve accountability and transparency, which is what I've been fighting for the last 17 years.
Woo-hoo!
So again, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
I guess we ask, do I take this to the bank, or do I?
Mark,
get us
to the instant teller. Just wanted to make a bit of an announcement. There are some people that were unable to make it here. Most of the northern part of Ontario has been snowed in, so Neil and Tabitha Haskett are unable to be here. We have someone else that will be speaking in their stead to convey their very important message about ombudsman oversight. Another person that was unable to come due to a very serious medical situation with a relative is Harry Capito. He was to have been our keynote speaker, but regrettably he had to travel out of the country. And I will tell you, this man has probably done more for justice than anyone else that I know. He has changed. He has caught judges altering court transcripts, and quite frankly, they just outright despise this man. Because, like he says, he's a thorn in the establishment's side. He expressed his apologies that he couldn't be here. In the 6 years that I've been working with him, this is the first time ever that he has not been there or been available. And again, he expresses his regrets for not being able to be here. At this point in time, I would like to call Vernon Beck from Canada Court Watch to give us his presentation and his views. of the Children's Aid Society and our legal system.
Well, thank you, Philip. I guess I'm still shaking a little bit. I wasn't expecting to receive such a generous check, which will be going certainly to some good good causes and again, promoting accountability and transparency. Today, I'm not here to talk about any specific things in regards to Children's Aid. I know a lot of the people here are what we may call the converted already. Before I come up here, I thought of and there's a couple comments that were said to me today too, which made me come up with a topic that I'm going to talk about today, which is more on the issue, I guess, of human spirit and an accomplishment that we all can do. I'm going to start by giving a little bit of background as where I got started into this whole industry. I started about 17 years ago. I was going through a messy divorce. I was married to a woman who was bipolar. I never knew what bipolar was at the time. But certainly when it came time for us to split up, I certainly knew pretty quick at the time. I seen the horrors of the family court. I seen the judges that just did not get it. I seen the Children's Aid Society that did not get it as well. Miserably failed. I think I had there has been a recent article. Most of you people have seen this issue about the gun. How many people have seen about the picture of the gun and the father who was arrested? How many? Give me a show of hands here. So most of you are aware of that recent incident. Well, let me tell you, it may be in my car. I was going to pass it around, but I forgot to bring it in. But I had a picture that was drawn by my stepson. And it had hundreds of guns in it. And at that time, he wanted to kill himself because the guns were pointed at him because his mother was beating and abusing him so much that he felt like killing himself. And the Children's Aid Society supported the abuser getting custody of that little boy. Today, he sits in a basement. He's in his late 20s, does not have one friend, has severe social issues, and I can go right back to the days that the family courts and the Children's Aid Society failed that young boy at that time. But anyways, getting on to that, when I was going through my horror, one night when I started to see the horrors of what was going on in these courts, I woke up in the middle of the night and I remembered the judge and I started thinking. I said, I got to write about this. And the idea of Canada Court Watch came into my mind. It was like about 2:30 in the morning. I woke up and I said, I've got to write something. And I went down to my computer and I wrote the first Canada Court Watch report. And that had to be about at least about 16 years ago. And that's where the idea of Canada Court Watch started. Now, initially, I was kind of naive and I said, oh, we've got a good system here. We got judges, we've got a system that wants to bring justice. So I got into mediation. I took a mediation training quite a few years ago, got a certificate as a family mediator to go into the courts. Immediately, I was under attack for being a mediator. Nobody wanted me. In fact, I soon found out nobody wanted anybody who was a mediator who wasn't a lawyer. You had to be a lawyer mediator. You had to charge $400 an hour for the court to want you. And that's where I first started to see that there was something bigger going on in the court system and in our legal system. And as time went on, I started working in an area called hostile aggressive parenting. And if anyone does any search on the internet, I actually coined the phrase hostile aggressive parenting back around, I think it was around 1997. I assembled a team of over 30 lawyers, psychologists, family counselors, very reputable people with degrees from all over Canada, and I headed a committee, and we worked on this work called hostile aggressive parenting. Based on what I've seen is that the problems in the courts are actually quite simple. But it seemed that everybody had to be a professional. You had to pay a lawyer $400 an hour. You had to go and get an assessment at $400 an hour. Basically, you had to go broke to play in the system. So that started to become very apparent to me. First time I testified in court, everybody ganged up on me. The judge, the lawyers, nobody wanted to hear what I had to say. So I started to catch on pretty quick after that. And that's where the idea of Canada Court Watch came about. We actually started to make up little badges. They're about the size of this calculator here. I used to start going into the court, this hanging around my neck with a string, you know, one of those plastic things. Before I knew it, I had another half a dozen people, so we'd go in, four or five of us at a time. And every lawyer and every judge would sit there, and for about the first 60 seconds, they'd be turning their necks and staring back at us, saying, "Who are those guys?" And everybody would be asking, you know, "Who are you guys?" And that's kind of where the concept of Canada Court Watch started many years ago. And so we started uncovering stories, and a lot of the work I did initially was in the family court. Divorces, separation, basically in that area. Children's aid, to me at that point, was kind of a side issue. You know, we saw a little bit of it in there. But as I started to learn more about the system, I became more educated, and I seen what was going on. Lawyers would start to talk to me and tell me about what was happening on the inside. And yes, they said, "Yeah, there's bad things going on here. If you know, if you've got connections, you can get court cases, will go whatever way you want as long as you've got connections." I still get lawyers calling me today with similar stories, and I have recorded interviews with lawyers today who tell me that this is going on today, right in here in Ontario and other parts of the country as well. So as things, I guess, went on over the years, I did work on hostile aggressive parenting, which was quite a project. The work in Canada Court Watch expanded, and more people became involved, more supporters. We developed a website, and back then social media wasn't as big as it was today. We used tape recorders that were real tape recorders, okay? And we used to go in and do recordings. And sometimes it'd be embarrassing because, you know, when the tape gets to the end, the button would click out. Suddenly you'd be in the court or something like this, and all of a sudden, pop, you'd hear this button, everybody'd be looking around. Well, anyways, certainly the technology back then wasn't what it is today. But we still went ahead. We first uncovered this issue about the law, about recording in your own court. How many people, I'm curious, how many people in this room here know that it is your right to take a recording device into the court and to record your own court proceedings? Fair number. How many people have picked that up from probably information we've disseminated out there from Canada Court Watch? Well, most people have picked that up, and let me tell you what happened, where that came about. We first uncovered that in about 1997 in the Hamilton Court. Never been tested before. We found out about this with our research. Went into the court. And I'll tell you, you should have seen the room. Everybody's eyes opened up wide when we had someone challenge this and bring the tape recorder out. And the judge was the judge didn't know what to do. So he said, "Well, I'll let it happen, but you've got to turn the tape recorder over to the court reporter, and we're going to keep it in the court overnight." And the judge had to go and consult with his legal books and that as to what they were going to do with this tape recorder, because we were successful the first day. When we came back for the second day of court, the judge realized that the law did exist out there and allowed, that was the first time that we ran across where recording was allowed, and the person walked out of the court with recordings of his court hearing. That was around 1997. And that's where the issue started. Now, here's what started happening. We raised this issue. Suddenly, we've seen more court security, metal detectors, and that suddenly started being installed. Now people were starting to be harassed. Okay? So it seemed that the system, even though the law was there, the judges and the lawyers started to find some way that they were going to fight back. And that's still going on today. But you know, a funny thing happened. I think it was about, my memory's a bit faded here, but I'm just trying to remember. It seemed to me it was in the early 2000s. a retired judge contacted me, and he said that no one was to ever know who contacted me, that this was completely off the record. And he passed me a arranged to have a piece of paper sent in the mail to me, and it was a director from a Justice Howland. And how many people have read that director from Justice Howland? Well, I'll tell you, nobody knew about that until that piece of paper had been sent over to Court Watch. That had been carefully manipulated by the system to vanish, and nobody, hardly anybody knew about it. Unless you knew where to research it, you'd probably never found it. You'd never find it. Well, anyways, that was passed over to us, and of course we published that. We wrote a document recording your own court hearing, and we put Justice Howland's directive in there. And of course, that's been going on. So over the years, there's been a number of cases where people are recording, where there's still problems where people aren't getting in. And the funny thing I notice, even when I was up in Bracebridge just a couple months ago, I think back in the summertime with Chad there, what they do now is they publish the Courts of Justice Act, but they only publish Part 1, which says you can't record. And they've conveniently taken off Part 2, where it says the exception is if this is your court case, you can go ahead and record. And they've got these laminate signs up there. So the first thing I did was tear it down. I was in the courthouse. I just tore it down and put it in my briefcase because I wanted to. I'm going to scan it and send it to the Attorney General and say what's going on here. So over the years, these are where kind of Court Watch got its beginnings. Now over the years, there's been a lot of people. I mean, there's people wearing T-shirts now. There's a number of people that are supporters. There's rallies going on. And in a sense, it all started one night at about 2:30 in the morning where I woke up and said, I need to write something about this judge. And Canada Court Watch was the name I came up with at that time. Now, a lot of my time over the years has been spent doing a lot of writing and research, because one of the beliefs I've always had is that in this problem we've got, it's going to take a body of evidence to bring it down and a fight. So in this process, I mean, there's a lot of documents, brochures, flyers that we've produced over the years. Some of the major things I've done is the issue about the schools. How many people are aware that it's against the law for workers to go into schools? Okay? It's a violation of their charter rights. And a lot of the school boards have been allowing this because they've been fooled over the years. So without going into that issue, I mean, there is the document, Schools and the Children's Aid Society, on our website, Canada Court Watch website. There is a questions and answers for school officials that was developed in the last couple of years. So that's an issue. Many of you have probably read the document that I wrote, The Unlawful Practice of Social Work in Ontario by Children's Aid Society Workers. How many people have read that document? Again, I spent months writing that, researching that. But again, bottom line is that people are breaking. There's a massive breaking of the law in the province of Ontario, and they're getting away with it. I've sent two letters to the minister, and not one of my letters has ever been challenged, the claims I've made. Never been challenged by the minister. In fact, the new minister we've got has not responded to my letter. Yeah. The problem is, years ago before I started into this, and when I was young, I believed we live in Canada. We lived in one of the best countries in the world. We have justice here. We have a good legal system. And my experience has been such that I have found out, and I can definitely, based on my 17 years of working at this, I can tell every one of you people in this room that the system is out of control, it's corrupt. Not to say that there are not some good people out there. There are some good judges, there are some good social workers, there are some good lawyers, but many of them are in fear themselves. One lawyer told me, he says, if I was to, for instance, tell my clients that they had the right to record in court, I would probably get punished by the judges when I take my clients into court after this, because they do not want lawyers telling their clients this type of thing. So they'll get even. So there are some good people in there that, again, themselves, they're afraid to speak out. And of course, that's the problem we have with whistleblowers, no matter where you go. You know, they're afraid to step out. But one thing is changing, though, and as I say, as I look around this room, I myself, it started with one idea, and it grew. And as I look around this room, you know, some people say, well, sometimes it's disappointing to see maybe attendance, or we have the converted here, and which is why I guess today I decided to kind of change what I was going to talk about, because I just decided on my way over here today what I was going to talk about. And these things start with one idea, with one person. And this gets down to the human spirit and what each of us can do. There are things that the Canada Court Watch has done and I've helped do, and it's helped a lot of people. And those people I can see now are helping other people. And this is where it all starts. I can see the faces here, and I know. I see children here who I've helped, and their lives have likely been changed forever because of what us out here as advocates are doing. Now, there are a few projects that are coming. Oh, I was going to say, one thing that has changed, though, even in the last few years, the term social media is a key word now. And you know, even 5 and 10 years ago, when we had that judge contact us, social media did not really exist then. And you know, we are on the beginning of a wave of changes that are going to come to the system. And I believe that, I bet you everyone in this room has been connected by social media, through the internet, through Facebook, through whatever, through websites. And you know, we in this movement, which is about justice and about Children's Aid Society and about the family courts, we are on the beginning of a movement, and you people are some of the most dedicated, and you're here today through social media. And also, I'm trying to, in a sense, encourage you to realize that each one of you can do a lot once you are motivated. Each of you will find your own area that you will excel in and do something about it. One of the things that I'd like to just briefly mention, because I mean that check will come in handy, is that one of the projects we're working on right now, which is I have a lot of hope for, is we are beginning a website. It's called the Canadian Registry for Public Accountability. We started working on this back in January. It's taking a tremendous amount of programming. It's going to be an extremely complicated site, but what it is that everybody in this room will be able to log on. You will be able to put the names of those people that you know who have affected you, who affected your family, and you can spread the word to other people to put the names of lawyers, social workers, judges, police officers, child psychologists, these people that are out there doing these fake assessments and parenting assessments that basically they're getting paid by the Children's Aid Society. These arbitrators that basically are cooking decisions behind the scenes. You'll be able to put the names of these people on this website and put whether you recommend or do not recommend them. And we're hoping that this will start to spread the word to other Canadians. And where I think it's going to pay off, for instance, if there is a particular social worker or a judge where a lot of complaints come in, we can link the people up and to say, here, we've got a target here. Because you know, when you go to launch a lawsuit or a class action lawsuit, you need the testimony. So if you want to go after somebody and suddenly you realize that there's another 40 or 50 people who would love to support you with their testimony, that can go a long ways. And this is what social media is doing. It's going to connect people. So this website here will start to connect people in that regards. Believe me, it's going to make a lot of enemies for us. We probably are going to be attacked. I'm sure the lawyers are going to try to find some way to shut us up. And it's going to be one of the first websites of its type that's going to be this intensive. Now, we are also, right now, we're working on one of our first surveys. We're going to put out a Canadian surveys. And the first one we're working on right now is on the Children's Aid Societies across Canada. We want everyone who's had an experience with Children's Aid to, when this is up and running, we want statistics. We are going to gather some of the most powerful statistics that have ever been gathered in this country before. Statistics that the system does not want people to know about, and they do not want the politicians to know about. At the same time, those who are going to survey, it's one of the things, these surveys are going to be extremely credible because we are asking for everyone to identify themselves. Their personal information will be kept confidential. It will not be visible to anybody, but we are going to be able to go to the government and we are going to say that this statistics are 100% reliable because we are going to contact by phone everyone who submits a form, and when we go to the government, we're going to say these numbers are probably more accurate. They're going to get from your Ipsum Reid poll because, and we're taking the belief that Canadians who really do want to stand up and want to change the system are going to stand up. So there's going to be some, this website we're hoping is going to be probably visible probably sometime this month. It won't have all the stuff on it, but we're hoping to be able to get it so people can start putting in some names and to get registered. So keep an eye open for that. That'll be very soon. The website, cost-wise, it's going to cost us a few thousand dollars to get done. A huge amount of very detailed programming involved in it. And that's why I said this check will help us quite a bit in that endeavor. But in closing, I think, how long have I been now? Who's keeping track of time here? Am I okay? You're good? Okay. Just in closing here, as I said, Martin Luther King is somebody that inspires me. And he's got a few good quotes, but it's not so much the quotes that inspire me. But you know that when he started the black movement in the United States, the first meeting that they had, I think there was probably less than six people at that meeting. And you know, it all started because there is a black woman who refused to sit at the back of the bus. Who knows who she is?
Rosa Parks.
That's right. And you know, that one person started a movement that changed the world. And look what we got now. There's a black president. Okay? And you know, when I was a kid, and I was pretty young, I can remember when the riots were in the United States. So it wasn't that long ago. It was in my generation. And I could remember seeing the smoke because I lived in Niagara Falls, Ontario. We could see the smoke rising from the buildings that they were burning down. They would burn entire strips of Main Street. Buildings, commercial buildings were being burned down. Streets were being barricaded. My father worked over in the United States in Niagara Falls. He took a 4-foot billy club that had been drilled out and filled with lead because he said if you ever pulled down the wrong street when the riots were on, you may never come out alive. So, but getting back to the bad parts, there's many bad parts of that, but if you get back to it, that whole movement started with one person refusing to sit at the back of the bus and moved into a whole movement which changed the world. One other person, which I'll leave, I guess, as a final comment as I leave here with each one of you, it's from Margaret Mead. Everybody know who Margaret Mead is? Okay, well, she's the person who talked about the inspiring of people. And here's her quote. I may be off on one or two words here, but she says, "Never doubt that a small group of dedicated people can change the world. because that's all that ever has. And that's a fairly famous quote. So as I said, just as Martin Luther King started off with a small meeting, look around this room here, people. You are dedicated people. Court Watch started off with one idea and one person. And we are, and another thing that's educated me about the system is that throughout the world there are struggles. We are in a struggle, people, for our freedom, democracy, our children. And you know, this is just a different kind of struggle, because in other countries they're killing people. They shoot them, they bomb them. Over here, they steal your children, they steal your money, they steal your house, they financially break you, what we're doing over here. And we all have to fight it. So hopefully that's all I've got to say for today. I think my 30 minutes is up, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Vern. That was an outstanding, as always, informative lecture on some of the things that Canada Court Watch is doing for the community. And I'm very thankful, Vern, that you were able to get well enough. Some may not know, but he has a pneumonia. So I'm very thankful that you were able to come out and give us your...
It's over now.
Good. Our next speaker is going to be Jane Scarf. Jane Scarf has traveled from Ottawa, and I've recently gotten to know her, and we speak quite a bit on the phone. I must say that she has impressed me tremendously. She happens to be an incredibly dedicated advocate, to advocate for the rights of those that are impoverished or those that are slighted by CAS. She has taken such an immense position that she has consciously decided to spend time in prison to protest. And I'm not sure what those are. Maybe you may want to touch on that a little bit. I'm not 100% clear. But I'd like you to put your hands together for Jane Scarf.
Hi, that was a nice introduction. I hope I live up to it. The issue that Atella addressed as far as risking arrest has to do with a document that I put up on archive.org, which is a constitutional challenge filed by a young mother who had her child apprehended in hospital at birth without any cause. One of these risk prevention deals where they were identifying her as a teen mother who had been in Children's Aid. Those were the two so-called risk factors. And what transpired from there was nothing short of a nightmare. And it's still continuing. The children are still in care. Her second child was also taken at birth as well, with no cause again. And she's been very brave in her dealings with the Children's Aid, and very fastidious in terms of doing all that was required of her and addressing the problems, complaining about the problems, and all you know, the legal wrangling and so on. And for the majority of the time, she's actually self-represented, and I think that's given her an advantage, because she wasn't shy to put forward her best foot, even if it was going to leave Children's Aid looking like the monsters they are. She didn't have any hesitation in putting that forward. So prior to that, what my first presentation with the Children's Aid involved was working in a group home, and I witnessed ongoing use of restraint on children for non-compliance rather than for danger. And they were being restrained, full physical restraint, which is very risky. It can cause death, even broken arms, all that sort of thing, for things like not doing their homework or not taking a shower, that kind of thing. And I complained, you know, within the group home system, and I ultimately ended up getting fired. So I pursued the complaint further with the police, and they were initially responding, but then they called CAS to advise that they were going to investigate these allegations of assault, excessive use of force, and Children's Aid advised the police that they were going to take over the complaint. And they proceeded to so-called investigate without speaking to me, who's the complainant, at all, not even Boo. Didn't speak to the parents and didn't speak to the children involved. And after a month, I called to find out what the results were, and they said, that's confidential. They can't tell me. So, you know, that's my first sort of bird's eye view of how they're operating. And the second involved a young girl that I met that was street involved for a number of years. And when she became pregnant, she pulled herself off the street, got herself off drugs, so on and so on and so on. But that had no bearing on the action CAS took. They were right after her, like flies on shit. Basically, before the child was even born, we were successful. There was a number of people that helped intervene with her first child, and we got them to back off. And that first child ended up dying of SIDS. And then she had another child, and this time the child had spina bifida, so the mother had to have the cesarean, very serious condition the child was in, and it was going to be a month before she was going to know how serious the condition was. So she was in the hospital herself, and CAS harassed her so badly, it's a long story, but the short of it, they harassed her to the point of suicide, and that was in 2008, and the coroner investigation also brought in a police investigation at the same time of allegations that I was making of criminal harassment causing death, and the police were supposed to do a preliminary investigation and then decide if they should do a full investigation based on what they found. And they did decide that there was a warrant. It did warrant a full investigation, but there's still no results since 2008. And then the situation with Sophie. So what I'm wanting to talk to you about now is about my understanding of charter rights in the criminal justice system versus the lack of charter rights with regard to the children's aid system. I'm not giving a legal opinion on this matter. I'm going to give you first an outline that's on the Canadian Bar Association website, and then my own observations in terms of whether these rights are adhered to in the child protection litigation process, which I've just been witnessing for the last 2 years in the case of Sophie X. And my bottom line here is there are no rights in there. They're all gone. Every last flipping one of them. And a few extra, you know, disadvantages to boot. So the first and foremost problem exists with the right to be considered innocent until proven guilty. That's what we have in a criminal action. And in what that means is that the onus is on the state or the crown to prove that you've done something to your children. Like if your child protection process was going to be going under the criminal justice system, the crown would have to prove that you did something wrong. And you don't have to do anything. They have to bring all the proof forward, and they have to bring a considerable amount of it before a conviction is forthcoming, and certainly no action against you until it's proven. But in and originally that's how child protection did operate in Canada under the Constitution. But over the years, the provincial government has gradually introduced legislation that removes the criminal process and puts in place a civil process. And in the civil process, those rights aren't there. The right to be considered innocent until proven guilty is not in the civil process. When you do a civil process, you have to prove that you have more evidence supporting you than what the Crown, or not the Crown, but in this case CAS has. They're acting like the Crown, they're acting like a prosecutor. They're bringing an allegation and evidence against you. But they don't have to prove that beyond a doubt. You have to bring more evidence, and they have all the resources. They have the psychiatrists, they have the community people all jumping and snapping to their favor, and the court. Well, you know, like, how are you supposed to do that? And then on top of that, you are being penalized right off the bat. Like in the case of Sophie, her children are gone day one. Like, she has no chance to demonstrate. So how can you even prove that you have the capacity when your child is not near you? It's impossible. Absolutely impossible. So if it was a criminal process, even if say, there was a substantial complaint made and they needed to temporarily protect the child, at least there would be a requirement that proof be shown that harm had been done before that's made permanent. And that's the way our legal system was designed to operate, but that's not how it's operating now. And it's the province, don't forget, that's giving the Children's Aid this power. They have policing power, and it's even more than policing power because they can remove your child without a warrant. And even when they get a warrant, it doesn't have the same requirement of presiding or presenting proof. They just have to say they have reason to believe that a child, they don't even have to name the child, is in danger and they need to take them to a place of safety. Whereas if it's criminal, the police officer has to go to the JP to get a warrant, and they have to swear what evidence they have. And then the JP has to agree that that's sufficient evidence to be successful in a charge. And then it still gets reviewed by a judge really quickly before the process takes off. There's a sort of a preliminary discussion between the defense and the Crown and the judge before they decide it's going to go. So you've got, you know, all those levels of scrutiny to confirm that there's solid evidence to proceed with the case. Not so with Children's Aid. They have reason to believe. They don't even have to swear anything. And the only way you could refute that is to prove that they didn't believe it. Well, you can't do that. Whereas if the police lie on their information, which is a public document, and they say they have witnesses that they didn't have, or they have DNA or fingerprints that they didn't have, well, you can do something about that because it's something they've had to swear was being put on the table to make things go forward, but CAS doesn't have to do that. They have reason to believe that da-da-da-da, and there you go. So in the whole process also, in a criminal case, they have to tell you very quickly, very clearly what you've done, what is your offense, what you've done. Not so with Children's Aid. If any of you have had long cases with them, it's just like just act like Yosemite Sam. They just shoot and shoot and shoot until something hits. And furthermore, there's rules of disclosure, where if you're in a criminal case, you have the right to have all the information and the proof and the evidence and a chance to cross-examine witnesses. But in the Children's Aid process, everything's secret, everything's confidential, everything's got to be, you know, sort of kept away from you, to the point where, in Sophie's case, they were when sort of all the dust settled, they were trying to make a case that she was retarded, and they were actually using the word retarded in 2012, where the term is supposed to be intellectual delay, not, or disability, not retarded. But they didn't even show her the document. They didn't show her the assessment that they had from when she was young that apparently made this claim towards her, so she had no opportunity to address it or refute it or you know, have it analyzed by anyone. And the court even refused to make CAS give it to her, and yet that was their main, one of their main pieces of evidence to predict that she wasn't going to be able to care for the children properly sometime in the future, because she hadn't done anything wrong. She was very responsible with all of the obligations, even the extraordinary obligations on her during this whole process. So the bottom line is, we have to get things pulled back to what they were originally intended to be by law. They were intended to be a child protection system that was addressing charges of neglect and abuse through the criminal justice system, protected by all those rights, the protection from even unreasonable search and seizure. The issue that was mentioned earlier by Vern about going into the schools, and that's a form of unreasonable search in a manner, because they're gathering evidence. They're talking to the children. They're trying to get them to be a witness in the case. And that's another one. In a criminal proceeding, you have the right to remain silent, and anything you say can be used against you and all that stuff. But in CAS, you do not have the right to remain silent. They have various ways. They get court orders to get private documents all the time, like your medical records, or your, if they ever find out that you ever saw counsel or whatever, bang, that's going to be on the table, with or without your consent, by order of the court. The psych assessments also yield evidence that they use against you, and you don't have a choice. You're ordered to do that. Whereas in criminal court, the judge cannot order you to do that. He cannot order private files, which is your own, personal information, to be used against you, and they can't force you to. The only they can force you to go to a psychiatrist only to determine if you're fit to stand trial. They can't force you to go to a psychiatrist to get the psychiatrist to decide whether you might have committed that crime or something, or if you have some sort of mental illness that would make you predisposed to do some certain crime. They can't do that, but Children's Aid can. So that's another right down the toilet. I'm not going to go through it all now, but I put this document that I've done up on archive.org, so I can give people the link if they want to see the full version, because I've put out the history that shows the gradual regression of the Children's Aid. It started off, the criminal justice system dealt under the criminal code, under the Constitution, Section 9127, did all the matters of neglect and abuse, and private agencies did child welfare, which would include, I guess they would call them not foster homes and so on. They would have, I think they call them children's shelters in Canada, which would be like orphanages. And I think they did have placements with families or whatnot, but all the money for those processes had to be generated by donations from the community, and they had a very unreasonable process whereby children would be placed for apprentices at really young ages, and then their keep was paid by their labor. That obviously was something that needed to be worked out of the system. But what happened was the province originally just agreed to start paying for the welfare part of it, because the province is responsible for welfare. But then slowly, these agencies that started to get funding for welfare started to get more and more rights, policing rights. They started getting rights to apprehend the children and pursue the litigation and do the investigation. And they're not qualified to do that. They're not qualified to do investigations and use force. They have the right to use force when they're apprehending, with or without the police presence. And that's not... That's totally unique, as far as I know, to the child protection system. Anywhere else where force is permitted under legislature, there's requirements for training and the use of force, and then there's checks and balances, like we have ombudsman oversight, that sort of thing. Police have the right to use force, but there's all kinds of guidelines. There's not even any freaking guidelines, and the police guidelines don't apply they just don't have any standards. There's no one, no one watching. So, and then the group homes, the CAS is supposed to be overseeing the group homes. So, that's our first too. So, I just want to make sure that I hit all the right. and some sort of incidental regression. If you're in a child protection litigation case, you are not allowed to fire your lawyer without permission from the court with leave, with notice, which means there has to be 10 days notice given to the CAS that you're asking the court to allow you to fire your freaking lawyer. And that's only in child protection, nowhere else. Supreme Court or small claims court, all the tribunals, even in family court itself, which child protection is in family court, you don't have to have permission. You can fire your lawyer on the way in the door to the court. Once you're in there, that's a different thing, because once it's convened, then you can't talk. So even if you're saying fired, they could just say shut up. But before you get in there, as you're walking through the door, before the court is actually convened, you can dismiss your lawyer. And because you have to give notice, that means in the last 10 days you can't even get leave from the court, because you wouldn't have enough time to give notice. And since you don't find out until about 7 days before the trial what documentation the lawyer's going to give, you wouldn't even know if you had cause to fire the lawyer until 7 days. You can't fire him at that time. So this is just when the trial is set that you can't fire him, and that's about sometimes as much as 4 or 5 months away. So for all that period, you have to go to the court to get permission to fire your lawyer. And that is certainly not in the interest of the parent or the child. That's strictly in the interest of the system, because the lawyers are cooperating with, you know, their little agendas, and they have an easier time making their case when they don't really have a case if your lawyer is cooperating. And this is what I'm witnessing and what I'm hearing over and over again. Things like the lawyer withdrawing at the last minute, and there's no documentation given. That happened to Yvonne Craig. He said, oh, the legal aid papers weren't complete. And this is at trial as they're walking in. And she asked for an adjournment to get another lawyer, and the judge said no. So they went ahead and proceeded, even though she had no lawyer and no evidence. No documents at all. So, and that's not an isolated case either. I'm hearing all kinds of, this woman from Brockville that was protesting in Brockville, she was saying the CAS required her to take some courses or whatever, and she took them and she had the paperwork for it, and the lawyer didn't submit it into the court. So she told the judge, well, my lawyer didn't do it. Like, not there. So the judge isn't going to say, well, anything. Like, it's if your lawyer is not serving your interest, that's not a ground. As far as I know, that's not. Actually, I just heard there, if for mental incapacity, there's a case if your lawyer's not dealing in it. It's just a brand new case. But in child protection, it wouldn't apply. If your lawyer's not competent or not doing the job, that's not cause for an appeal. Like, that woman thought she had a cause for appeal because she had the documents and she gave them to the lawyer, and the lawyer didn't give them. It's not. And anyway, so what I think needs to happen, well, ombudsman oversight would certainly help, because it would clear up many of the unfair practices that we see that are actually not complying even with these regressive laws, such as going into the schools and interviewing children without the parents' knowledge or consent. In some cases, without even their knowledge, right? Like in the case of the man who drew the child who drew the gun, and the father was arrested and charged and whatnot. They didn't tell the parents that they were going to interview the children. They just whooshed them off to the CAS office, and that is not legal. They're only allowed to apprehend, which that is an apprehension, for in the case where the child's in danger, to take them to a place of safety. So they can't say the child is in danger in the school and they're bringing them to the CAS office where it's safe. Like, I wouldn't want my child in the CAS office. It's not safe. But regardless, that's the kind of thing that we can probably see immediate changes with ombudsman oversight. Like, the more serious problems with, you know, deficiencies in the legislation, he could probably make recommendations, but he can't actually make decisions or make much progress as far as you know, where our legislation is off. So it's going to take, I think, a broad-based public awareness that our, all of our legal rights that have been established over thousands of years, like these didn't just pop up even with the charter. Most of these were established over a long period of time in the justice systems, you know, that predated Canada even. And now, poof, they're gone in a puff of smoke. And people don't realize until they're in the situation. Because, like, for example, in the case of Sophie X, when they were apprehending her child in the hospital without a warrant, I said to them, she has a right to talk to a lawyer if you're going to be taking her children. And they went, no. And then they mocked me in their affidavit how this, like, stupid woman thought she had the woman had a right to talk to a lawyer. And I was like, come on, what's up with this? And I really, you know, like, presumed, because they were taking such an aggressive action, I just automatically presumed there would be a right to counsel, but there's no right to counsel. And in the civil court, the discretion on the judge is a lot broader in terms of what evidence he's going to allow, what witnesses are going to allow, that sort of thing. Whereas if it's the criminal trial, they don't have that much. If you need this evidence to demonstrate, you know, the system takes it more seriously because your liberty's at a stake and all that kind of stuff. But it should be equally considered in the case of removing children from their parents. Like, there shouldn't be much, if any, difference in the seriousness of that action by the state. But in one, they're just dealing with it exactly the same as if two people are fighting over who owns a house. So it's like, it's just not considered that important if, you know, if the judge kind of, you know, like, hurry up, we got to finish this, or, you know, things like that, because, you know, it's not as considered as critical as when somebody's liberty is at risk and that sort of thing. And here we have our children taken by the state with that same, you know, sort of lackadaisical consideration as by the justice system, as though we're fighting over, you know, who owns this house, like who should have these kids, just eeny, meeny, miny, mo or something. It's very, very, very scary. And I'm really glad to be part of this movement. I find that every day it seems to develop more focus, and a lot of effective things are occurring, and the potential to bring up awareness is really increased by this kind of networking and people taking the time to come and share with others their information and experiences. That really helps to round out one's understanding, and that's important to carry that message further, because until people realize that they have a lot to fear by the government's action with regard to their children, parental rights right now are pretty much non-existent. In the process that you've been given, everything is applied arbitrarily, which means that there's no regard to your parental rights. Even the Supreme Court has decided that the children's aid is the one that needs to decide the child's best interest. Well, you know, like, that's scary. You know, it's like Norman Bates and, you know, like, pretty psycho way to you know, run a community. You know, let's let these people who have no emotional interest or familiarity with these children decide the best interest of these children. But, and let's also pay them if they decide that removal is in the best interest of the child. Like, come on, like, that's so fundamentally wrong. It's even, like, exasperating, you know, to having to repeat it over and over, because we shouldn't have to deal with that. We should only be looking maybe at fine-tuning things here and there, We shouldn't have to look at such, massive legal correction. So I would say that what needs to happen is families that are in this kind of struggle with the Children's Aid should be looking at getting together and getting as much legal advice and direction as they can in terms of what options they might have to address this as a constitutional as many constitutional violations. For example, I forgot that we have a right to fair, open trial. It actually says that in the Constitution. What does CAS have? An unfair, closed trial. Like, closed to everybody. So every time you go to court, then, if you're not allowed to speak about it under Section 45A, that's a violation. Every single time you go to court, there's another violation. Every time they acquire personal information about you to use against you, that's another violation. Force you to have a psych assessment and they pay for it, which is a bias process, another violation. Denial of counsel, everything like that. Not telling you clearly what you've done, all those things. So I think if say a group of people could sort of gather as much direction as they can for something along the lines of a federal charter challenge, that's what it'll take. That legislation that is problematic needs to be eliminated. And we could go back to what the original framework was, which is federal government doing child protection and provincial government doing child welfare. And they shouldn't be mixed because it's a conflict of interest to mix them. And it's also illegal to mix them because the charter is very clear that you're not supposed to mix and match jurisdictions. What is the jurisdiction of a specified level of government cannot be abdicated and it can't be circumvented. It has to remain with that until legislation is changed. So that's where I would leave that. And I'll be talking to you later on today about self-representation.
Thank you very much, Jane. And I was remiss in not mentioning the fact that Jane is a licensed paralegal.
Yes.
Sanctioned by our famous or some
the shame of
consider it infamous Law Society of Upper Canada. Incidentally, one time when I was talking to them, I had a lawyer that I needed to get him to recuse himself, to remove himself from a case where my ex-wife had hired him, and I offered to bring information to the Law Society about facts that he knew, which guaranteed that he should have come off of record. The Law Society staff told me that an affidavit was not a worthy document. They were unreliable. Now, I don't quite understand how the Law Society staff could say such a thing when an affidavit is the most powerful document that you could write. Our next speaker is going to be Bobby Gellner, and she is going to be speaking on behalf of Neil Haskett, who I said earlier got snowed in Sudbury. Tabitha, his wife, and her four children were going to be here today, but they were just unable to drive down. So if we could have Bobby convey information that Neil would have conveyed to us personally.
I can talk loud enough. As Vern was saying about the social media, because Neil can't be here, he just sent me a message on the phone to read out to everyone. So he says, "Hello, my name is Neil Haskett. My wife Tabitha and I would like to apologize for not being able to attend today. But Northern Ontario has been snowed in and we felt it was safer to stay at home with the family. I'm with the Ontario Coalition for Accountability and also one of the administrators for Stop the Children's Aid from taking children from good parents. Basically, the best way to describe us is that we're the political side of the Children's Aid
movement, if you will, and have been working with other groups to organize rallies and media specifically for the ombudsman bills over hospitals, long-term care homes, school boards, police retirement homes, universities, and most importantly, children's aid societies. As some of you know, with a lot of hard work, we all got one Bill 83 to second reading. While some see the bill getting shot down as a loss, we see getting any bills surrounding CAS this far for the first time as a major victory. What excited us most about second reading of Bill 183 was that the opposition parties are very limited to the number of bills they can move forward, and out of all the other issues facing Ontarians, they chose to move our bill forward. Now for the good news. A lot of people have been asking me since the October provincial election, what's the status of the next ombudsman bill? Well, I have some great news. Your wait is over. Nearly over. Yesterday, the Ontario CFA had a meeting with the Ontario NDP to discuss the next bill, its introduction date, and our plan of attack. What we can tell you so far is the introduction of the next ombudsman bill remains one of the NDP's highest priorities as it's been since 2006. The introduction is tentatively set after the Ontario Liberals release Ontario's 2012 budget. We expect that to be the end of March or early April. Further information will be released as it becomes known, and we will keep you posted. The most important part of our message to you all today is that we need to immediately shift focus from just Facebook and rallies. We must all encourage everyone we know to make their own appointments with their MPPs and begin submitting petitions in each community. Without this work by everyone representing all the groups here today, there will be no point to risk moving a bill forward if we can't get another 20 or so MPPs on board. There is a chance with our lobbying this bill could be also be co-sponsored with another party. Sorry. And we will certainly be guaranteed that our fight to have children's aid societies investigated will be over with once and for all. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Bobby. At this point in time, and before I call this gentleman up, I just wanted to express just 2 weeks ago, just so you understand what intimidation can occur by police officers. Just 2 weeks ago, I was in court on two paper charges, and this stemmed from my witnessing a man being dragged across his front yard. There was the SWAT team there. I counted no less than 10 police officers to arrest one man. I elected to take a video of this. The SWAT officer motioned me to put my camera down, and I know my rights. I refused to cooperate. What ensued from there is five police officers descended on me, and I will tell you exactly what happened. One of them said, are you taking pictures? I said, am I not allowed to take photographs? His response was, don't answer me with a question. Don't make me embarrass you in front of your kids. Now, I'm not going to get into any more specifics because the matter is before the courts. But in court, I was in front of the Justice of the Peace where I explained that I would need an adjournment. I will need to subpoena witnesses into my case. And she asked me how many. I said, well, no, 10 police officers. Found it a bit strange that I would need that many witnesses. But the important part is, as the court recessed, the officer that intimidated me in the street walked up to me in court and started to question me about disclosure and insinuating that I was not being truthful. And he said, well, this is mischief. He stood half a foot away from me, very close, and I told him this discussion is over. At that point, he instructed me to sit down. I said, don't tell me what to do. What this police officer didn't realize is there's laws against intimidating a witness. Now, I'm not going to say what I did, but I promise you that I have the evidence
to ensure that this man is not going to get away with intimidating somebody. And sometimes we need to take drastic measures to protect ourselves. Such as the case that we recently heard about, Jesse Sansone, I believe is the name. 4-year-old little girl goes to school, draws a gun on a whiteboard. Teacher says, "What is that?" She says, "Oh, that's my dad's gun." And he shoots bad people or bad men and monsters with it. Totally natural, totally normal. What comes out of that? He's arrested at school, handcuffed, taken to the police station, and thrown in prison. Told that he's going to be charged in jail. Absolute nonsense. One of the things that I've recognized and continue to recognize is there's a common denominator in our problems. Whether it's criminal, family, it ends up touching on CAS every time. Because the police, when they're called, if there's kids involved, they need to call the CAS. They say by law. Once that happens, you're down a path of horror. And that horror is what Chris Carter has been attempting to help other people to find ways of dealing with children's aid hands-on. And as he got close to the Chatham-Kent Children's Aid Society's nerves, he stepped on their big toes. They didn't like it very much. So they figured, well, let's find a way of shutting Mr. Carter up. What did they do? They had him charged. Spent 2 days in prison on a completely malicious and vexatious charge that was altered and changed. I spoke with the Crown Attorney personally. She was very nebulous in explaining what the perimeters are, either for what they were doing, what the publication ban was, and I'm not going to get into any further details of that, as it is before the courts, and we don't want to have any of these people gain additional information that we don't want them to have prematurely. In time, I promise you, what they did to Mr. Carter is not going to be allowed to be swept away. They will be held accountable. And Canada Court Watch sticks up for their own. I will add that over a period of about 2 or 3 days, I spent many hours gathering information from the Chatham-Kent CAS, completely giving me the runaround, begging me to give them my name. And I said, hey, I can make an anonymous complaint. Again, I'm not going to get into details, but some of the things that I heard the Children's Aid Society doing with some children is outright vile. Vile and criminal. And I want to make sure that that's going to be investigated, not by one of their own, but by the police. And if they don't do a proper job, I will certainly help in making sure that there's a criminal investigation, not only into your wrongful arrest and incarceration, but to the things that the Chatham-Kent CAS is doing to families who are normal people just looking to raise a child. So please put your hands together for Chris Carter.
Hi, everybody. I'm Chris Carter, originally from Cambridge, Ontario. And there have been a number of wonderful points made up during the presentations today, or presented during the speeches today. And I do want to initially say thank you to a couple of people who really, really, I know that all of you extended your support and best wishes for me while I was in jail those couple of days, which wasn't a terrible ordeal for me because I'm getting used to being in jail because of the Children's Aid Societies and the police and the courts and all of that stuff. But it was still, I want to thank Attila and Jane Scharf. They both really went to bat for me, and I really, really appreciated that. As well, Chad coming up from Peterborough, Chad Wells, and Trish Watson and Lee Bolton attending the court appearances. It really, really made a difference, I think, and put a lot of pressure on the police, the Crown Attorney, and the courts, and let them know that I'm part of a very determined group, specifically Canada Court Watch, and that my back is being watched. And I want to thank you guys for that. Like I said, I don't want to say that I'm getting used to being in jail, but since my three older children were kidnapped from me by a babies and child apprehensionist specialist by the name of Paulette Kane from the Waterloo Regional Children's Aid Society back on Friday, July 21st, 2006. Ms. Kane kidnapped my children. Well, her actions qualify as Criminal Code of Canada kidnapping charges. And once my children and I are reunited, we will be pursuing Criminal Code of Canada kidnapping charges against her. We will give the Waterloo Regional Police Service an opportunity to lay the charge initially. We will present the information to her or to them. If they choose not to do it, then we'll do it ourselves under Section 507.1 of the Criminal Code of Canada. But Paulette Kane will be charged for kidnapping because of what she did with my children. And since that kidnapping of my three older children from my legal custody, I have been incarcerated, let me see now, either two or three times at the Cambridge Courthouse for a day. Once at the end of the trial, which I did to gain access to my children, 22-day trial in the Cambridge Courthouse, in front of an absolute fraud and liar, a judge by the name of Patricia Hardman. If Patty Hardman isn't actually taking payoffs from the Waterloo Regional Children's Aid Society, she is doing an unbelievably accurate impression or impersonation of a judge who is taking payoffs from the Children's Aid Society. What happened in that 22-day trial was one of the most disgusting displays of abuses of power that I think has ever occurred in a courtroom in Ontario. For whatever reason, the criminal courts have, thankfully, recognized over the years that miscarriages of justice do occur. But for whatever reason, they have failed to recognize that miscarriages of justice occur in the family courts and the Children's Aid Society courts. They just have not had the morality or the integrity to do that. But that's definitely what happened with my children and I. And at the end of that trial, Justice Hardman ordered me to turn over my children's Canadian citizenship cards. My three older kids are half Japanese. Their mother's Japanese. And prior to coming to Canada in March 2004, the children and I were able to get their Canadian citizenship cards. Justice Hardman, at the end of the trial, July 2008, ordered me to turn over the Canadian citizenship cards. I could only find two out of the three cards, so that earned me my first stay in a jail. She sentenced me to 15 days in the Maplehurst Detention and Correctional Center. And I was to spend another, beginning in July 2010 and ending in September 2010, I was to spend another 52 days in the Maplehurst detention center. And that time, again, it was for protesting against the Children's Aid Society. But Vern gave a wonderful quote from Martin Luther King earlier. And when I was in the Maplehurst Detention Center that second time, there was a document floating around on the range. It was kind of like an American History X document. It gives you the American history from the version or from the point of view of the people who had been oppressed. And I learned about, an absolute hero by the name of Frederick Douglass, who was, born a slave back in 1817, but died a free man in 1895. He actually spent some time in Canada. But Mr. Douglass had many, many wonderful quotes, and there's one that always stuck with me, and I'd like to share it with you. He said, "If there is no struggle, there is no progress. Those who profess to favor freedom and deprecate agitation are men who want crops without plowing up the ground. They want rain without thunder and lightning. They want the ocean without the awful roar of its many waters. The struggle may not be a moral one, the struggle may be a moral one, or it may be a physical one, or it may be both moral and physical, but it must be a struggle. Power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did, and it never will." And that's where we are with the Children's Aid Societies. Absolutely, without a doubt, the Children's Aid Societies of the province of Ontario are the most severe and obscene child protection threat that has ever existed, not just in this province, not just in this country, but in the entire world. And we see that every time Canada Court Watch or one of the other advocacy groups gets out and protests publicly. We lead the entire world in terms of protesting against the child protection system. And there is a reason why. It's because it's because there is nowhere else in the world where the child protection system is as ugly, brutal, and deleterious as it is here in the province of Ontario. Now, I did want to get into a few specific issues. For those who are perhaps watching one of these information sessions for the first time, please, there are a number of wonderful websites which I ask you to investigate. Obviously, Canada Court Watch has an excellent internet website with a lot of information on it. There's one that I am particularly attached to, which is fixcas.com. John Dunn out of Ottawa has a wonderful website called the Foster Care Council of Canada. And there are a couple of new ones, CAS Ontario with Pat Niagara and Neil Haskett's, anybody know, Accountability Ontario or something like that? Ontario Coalition for Accountability. So please, if you're interested in any of the issues that are being discussed today, please get on those websites and check out the information on those websites. I've learned a lot over the years from looking at the internet websites. One of the most informative internet websites, in my opinion, has been the Ontario Legislative Assembly's website. And if you get onto that website, you can read Hansard transcripts. It takes a little bit of research, but what I would suggest is if you have the time, check out in 1999 Bill 6, which was a Mike Harris progressive conservative bill that very severely changed the Child and Family Services Act, obviously for the worse, in 8 significant ways. And that is one of the primary reasons, that bill is one of the primary reasons why so many innocent and precious children and families have been destroyed. So if you get on the website, I think it's if you get back to May 1999, Bill 6, you can do some research and kind of get a little bit of an idea of the history of it. As well, in 2006, Bill 210, that's another one that you can do some research and get an understanding of the legislative issues behind the Child and Family Services Act and the child protection litigation. The Provincial Coroner's Office of Ontario. In Ontario, if individuals die in certain specific circumstances, for example, if they die in a prison, or if they die in a mining accident, or if a child with Children's Aid Society involvement dies, there is automatically a a review of the circumstances of that person's death. Some of those reviews become public inquiries. If you're interested in the issue, you can contact the coroner's office and they will actually give you the inquests, the paperwork. I've probably got 15 cases myself, which I can forward to you. They are posted to fixcas.com, but that's another avenue if you want to do research and really become educated in regards to the child protection system. That's another thing that you can do. How can all of these children have died and not one single individual who was involved in their death from the CAS side being held accountable?
Good question, Mr.
How has it happened? You know, like it's one of the most disgraceful aspects of life in this province. Now, when you look at the history of child welfare here in Ontario, there were, I believe, 6 or 7 public inquests into the deaths of children here in Ontario during the mid-1990s. One of them occurred in the region of Waterloo, and there were some other that you can get all of those reports from the coroner's office. The government of Ontario basically used those inquests to justify the very severe changes that they made to the Child and Family Services Act via Bill 6 in 1999. In 1998, the Ministry of Children and Youth Services took over funding for the Children's Aid Societies for the first time. Before that, the provincial government provided funding to the municipalities or the counties, and they themselves funded the Children's Aid Societies, and that kept everything in more of a sensible balance. But in 1998, the Ministry of Children and Youth, or the Ministry of Community and Social Services, overtook funding. You can research all of that on the Ontario Legislative Assembly's website, and that was one of the contributing factors to this very severe situation we have today. In October 2003, the Ministry of Children and Youth Services was established. It was the first new provincial government ministry in 25 years, and they took over the child protection system from the Ministry of Community and Social Services. And then in 2004, something called the Child Welfare Secretariat was established. And I encourage you to research all this. And they came up with something called the Transformation Agenda, because the CASs were doing so much baby snatching. They were doing so much kidnapping that the government felt, you know, we're going to have a riot on our hands if we don't get a hold of this. So they came up with this transformation agenda where the Child Welfare Secretariat very graciously informed the province of Ontario that the best place for a child to grow up is with their family. Thank you so much, Child Welfare Secretariat, for allowing us to understand that the best place for a child to grow up is with their family. And what I strongly suggest is that for those of us who have been financially decimated by the child protection litigation fraud, for those of us who have been so emotionally and psychologically injured that you are unable to work and you are on Ontario Works or some other form of public assistance, you can use the Freedom of Information and Protection of Privacy Act, and the Municipal Freedom of Information and Protection of Privacy Act, and the Freedom of Information Requests process as a weapon to get some justice. And one thing, like for example, the Child Welfare Secretariat, anybody who's out there who is on OW, for only $5, you could put in a Freedom of Information request asking for all of the minutes of every Child and Welfare Secretariat meeting that has occurred. They meet once a week in the Ministry of Children and Youth Services office downtown Toronto, a nice secret little meeting, but through the Freedom of Information request process, we could get the minutes of their meetings. And if you're on OW, you can apply for what's called a fee waiver, and you can get all the documents for free. So that's another one of the websites that I suggest that people look at, the Information and Privacy Commissioner's website, and you can also read their decisions on Canley. Yes. In 2006, the Government of Ontario, well, the Child Welfare Secretariat, came up with Bill 210. And that, again, changed the Child and Family Services Act in a number of significant ways. This time a little bit better for our side, but it seemed that way at first, but it hasn't worked out that way. But Bill 210 is when the Child and Family Services Review Board's powers were expanded to allow them to hear complaints against the Children's Aid Societies for the first time. The Review Board had been in existence prior to 2006, but it was after 2006 that they were able to hear complaints against the Children's Aid Society. I strongly recommend that citizens utilize the Review Board, because I know that the Review Board is not a fan of the Children's Aid Society. You have a much better chance of getting some issues determined if you go in front of the Review Board as opposed to being in front of the court. We had a very wonderful decision right out of Hespler, Cambridge, Ontario, where a local mom back in 2009 got a great decision from the Review Board, something like 140 paragraphs. They ordered the Waterloo Regional Children's Aid Society to answer 9 questions. The Waterloo Regional Children's Aid Society did not want to honor that decision, so they appealed it to something called the Divisional Court, 3 judges in Hamilton. Those judges in 2010 set aside the Review Board's decision. So then the Review Board's lawyers appealed that decision to something called the Appeal Court, which is 3 judges in Toronto. In 2011, the Appeal Court judges reinstated the original Child and Family Services Review Board decision. And I don't need to tell you how many lawyers are making money during this process. I mean, it's absolutely unbelievable. So then the Waterloo Regional Children's Aid Society appealed the Appeal Court's decision to the Supreme Court of Canada. And on December 8, 2011, the Supreme Court of Canada said, we're not interested in hearing this case. The Appeal Court judges, 3 judges, were in unanimous decision. So fortunately, that Hespler, Cambridge, Ontario mom and her family were able to find a lawyer to file a lawsuit on their behalf, a $3 million lawsuit, which is filed in the Guelph Superior Court. The lawyer is doing it on contingency, so he's covering all the court costs out of pocket. And if they win, the family gets 70% and the lawyer gets 30%. And that's what we need, hopefully, more of, is lawsuits against the Children's Aid Society. I know I've been, you know, investigating the legal process now for a few years, and I know it's not an easy thing to do to draft a lawsuit and to pursue a lawsuit. So I know it's very difficult, but that would be lovely if we could get some more in. Now, 2006, Bill 210. Another one of the changes was the alternative dispute resolution process. I wonder how many of us know that the Child and Family Services Act obligates the Children's Aid Society, after they snatch a baby or kidnap a child, they have to sit down and have an internal meeting where they discuss whether or not a family is suitable to be offered the alternative dispute resolution option. The alternative dispute resolution process gets the case out of court, and in the statistics that I've read, 90% of the time the family's reunited in the alternative dispute resolution process. So if you get a chance to use the alternative dispute resolution process, I personally would suggest that you use it. The Children's Aid Societies, however, are not obligated to actually offer the families that option. All they have to do is sit down and consider it. They also, once every 3 months, they have to submit documents to the Ministry of Children and Youth Services showing that, in fact, they did have that meeting and the family was offered alternative dispute resolution, or the family wasn't offered alternative dispute resolution, and they have to explain why in that document. So if you want, that's another one of those documents that you can put in a Freedom of Information request for from the Ministry of Children and Youth Services. Because even though the Children's Aid Societies are not considered to be institutions, and so therefore do not have to honor Freedom of Information requests, the Ministry of Children and Youth Services most definitely is an institution, and they do have to honor Freedom of Information requests. So that's another thing that you can do. Bill 210 in 2006 also introduced something called the differential response model. And there are children here, so I won't say what I actually think about it, but it's a crock of you know what. The differential response model was supposed to be a policy whereby the Children's Aid Societies were to look at a family's circumstances and say, you know what, this family is fundamentally a good family, so we're not going to hit them with the full-on court process. We're going to just tweak them a little bit and send them on their way. That has absolutely not been applied whatsoever. It was a red herring policy change. But these are things that we can put pressure on the government about. Another one of the things with Bill 210 was the Children's Aid Societies had to establish something called internal complaint review panels. And so that's where the Children's Aid Society itself hears your complaint. And you can do some research about it on the internet. I strongly recommend that you utilize the process, obviously that you record it, because it's probably going to be a very, very fundamentally fraudulent process, but I suggest that you do use it. And that's where the Children's Aid Society they'll have four people hear your complaint. Three of the four people will be Children's Aid Society workers. And then the fourth one can't be a Children's Aid Society worker, but it can be one of their board of directors. And actually, quite often, is one of their board of directors. Don't bother looking for any statistics in regards to the internal complaint review panel. Don't go on the Children's Aid Society website to try and find out how many times in 2008 the internal complaint review panel was convened, because there are no statistics. They just simply do not provide any of that information with the public. Or to the public, you can't find out what decisions were made by the panel or anything like that. And as we know, and as Canada Court Watch has been repeatedly pointing out, the absence of statistics is a big indication that this child protection litigation fraud obviously led by the Children's Aid Society, is much larger than just the Children's Aid Society. It is a fraud that is completely and totally supported, facilitated, and encouraged by the provincial political establishment and the provincial legal establishment. And that's why it's so hard for us to break through, because this fraud is being supported all the way through. I don't think the province of Ontario has ever seen anything, except for maybe when the Japanese and the Italians and the Germans were interned back leading up to World War II. I don't know if this province has any seen a fraud as severe. Obviously the residential school systems, and other than those two, this has got to be the most severe fraud that this province has ever seen. Now, we've learned, Canada Court Watch has learned a few things over the years working for families. The Section 2, Subsection 2 of the Child and Family Services Act is called Duties of Service Providers. That section and the case, the DD versus Waterloo Regional Children's Aid Society case, the Child and Family Services Review Board case, those two factors of the system obligate the Children's Aid Society to provide written responses when families put in inquiries. So one of the things that we recommend, the Children's Aid Society is very intentionally nebulous when they present their case. They want families to be left guessing. Usually families are too afraid to ask the difficult questions. One of the things in terms of strategies and tactics that we can use is registering emails with the Children's Aid Society, specifically your worker, the worker supervisor, the executive director, the lawyer involved in your case, and the senior legal counsel. I would recommend that you send the email to your worker or to the supervisor, and you copy those other individuals. And the way that some of the families are having success is they do it like issue one, question 1, 2. Issue two, question 3, 4, 5. Issue three, and then register these emails with the CAS, and they have to provide written responses to your inquiries. If they don't, you bring it up in court, and you say to the judge, Your Honor, we registered this two-page email with them more than a month ago, and they haven't responded. They are violating Section 2, Subsection 2 of the Child and Family Services Act. They are violating the case law, DD versus the Waterloo Regional Children's Aid Society. Your Honor, can we get your judicial opinion on this issue? And back in 2004, Vern Beck attended seminar at the Law Society of Upper Canada. I believe it was a two-day weekend seminar, and there were some DVDs produced out of that seminar. There's been one since then, too, a 2007 seminar as well. And those DVDs are called The Best Practices in the Conduct of a Child Protection File. And I've watched the 2004 one over and over and over again. And I would say that probably the most important thing that I read or that I learned from those DVDs is that we have the right to continually and repeatedly be asking the judges for judicial opinions during the court proceedings. You don't have to wait for a hearing or a motion. All of those remand appearances that occur before a trial, sometimes a year or 2 years of them, we need to start making these judges work for the $250,000 or $300,000 that they're making a year. And we have to continually be saying, you know, Your Honor, based on the information that I've presented to you just now, based on the affidavit material that you have in front of you, will you please give us a judicial opinion on this issue? And just keep hammering it and hammering it and hammering it. And, you know, like something like, they're not responding to us, Your Honor. We're asking questions in writing and they're refusing to provide us responses. They're violating Section 2, Subsection 2, Duties of Service Providers of the Child and Family Services Act. Your Honor, what is your judicial opinion on this issue? Why is the Children's Aid Society refusing to provide us answers? And if we start to do that, we can put more pressure on them. Don't ever let your lawyer tell you that you can't get up and speak during a court appearance. You have a constitutional right to participate fully in your defense. And that means getting up and speaking. I suggest that you negotiate the issue with your lawyer, but because lawyers are members of the Law Society of Upper Canada, they are somewhat